Egzamin maturalny z języka angielskiego. Poziom dwujęzyczny. Usłyszysz dwukrotnie teksty do zadań od pierwszego do trzeciego. Przed wysłuchaniem każdego tekstu usłyszysz dźwięk. W nagraniu przewidziane są przerwy na zapoznanie się z poleceniami oraz treścią zadań, sygnalizowane dźwiękiem. Rozwiązuj poszczególne zadania w trakcie słuchania nagrań oraz w czasie przerw po ich wysłuchaniu.
Task 1. Read the instructions and the task carefully.
Speaker A.
The desire to achieve status tempts many to bend the rules along the way. But people may also cheat to avoid a loss of status. Nathan Pettit from New York University decided to measure the relative influence of these two factors. According to his findings, people are more likely to engage in deception in order to avoid a loss, rather than to secure an equivalent gain. In one experiment conducted by Professor Pettit, a group of participants was asked to write a persuasive argument on a given topic, and each participant was subsequently informed that he or she had ranked third in the group. Some were then told that by successfully solving a series of mathematical problems, they could boost their ranking to second place, whereas others were informed that by doing the same, they could avoid slipping to fourth place. Crucially, participants were instructed to self-report the number of maths problems they had correctly solved. It turned out that those apparently facing a downgrade were more likely to have cheated than those who believed they had the possibility of an upgrade.
Speaker B.
We do it on busy streets, in subway stations, at the doctors, and wherever there are unfamiliar faces. We steal glances, wondering about the people around us and their lives. Given that people watching is a widespread activity, others are probably watching us about as much as we watch them. Yet research reported in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology suggests that most people watchers are not aware of this. In 6 studies, participants consistently tended to estimate that they observed strangers more than strangers observed them. Even making direct eye contact with someone might not be enough to undermine this belief. When roughly 100 Yale students were questioned about the conclusions they typically reached upon meeting the gaze of a stranger, fewer than a quarter said that they believed they were being observed.
Speaker C.
There is a theory that playing music makes you more intelligent, and thus academically more successful. This conviction has encouraged countless ambitious parents to enroll their children in after-school music classes. But Professor Glenn Schellenberg says that it is a waste of time for children to attend music lessons purely in order to improve their educational performance. Schellenberg studied the link between musical training and intelligence in 130 children. He found that when he factored in the likely effect of each child's personality traits, in particular conscientiousness, the link between music training and intelligence disappeared. Conscientious children tend to take music lessons more often than others, but it's their personality type, not their violin or piano playing, that makes them do well at school.
Speaker D.
Ask around and you'll discover that almost everyone can recall being stuck next to a stranger who wouldn't stop going on about his or her health, job or marriage. The Harvard sociologist Mario Small says that we all tend to confide in strangers more than we realise. Almost half the respondents in a study led by Professor Small, when asked who they'd most recently confided in, admitted that it wasn't someone who they knew well. In a lonely, atomized society, it might seem that we simply turn in desperation to whoever happens to be around. And in a minority of cases, Mario Small did indeed find that sheer availability was the key factor. But his research shows that we frequently choose strangers on purpose because they are more likely to lend an ear and less likely to judge than those with whom we have the strongest bonds. Listen to the recording once again.
Speaker A.
The desire to achieve status tempts many to bend the rules along the way. But people may also cheat to avoid a loss of status. Nathan Pettit from New York University decided to measure the relative influence of these two factors. According to his findings, people are more likely to engage in deception in order to avoid a loss, rather than to secure an equivalent gain. In one experiment conducted by Professor Pettit, a group of participants was asked to write a persuasive argument on a given topic, and each participant was subsequently informed that he or she had ranked third in the group. Some were then told that by successfully solving a series of mathematical problems, they could boost their ranking to second place, whereas others were informed that by doing the same, they could avoid slipping to fourth place. Crucially, participants were instructed to self-report the number of maths problems they had correctly solved. It turned out that those apparently facing a downgrade were more likely to have cheated than those who believed they had the possibility of an upgrade.
Speaker B.
We do it on busy streets, in subway stations, at the doctor's, and wherever there are unfamiliar faces. We steal glances, wondering about the people around us and their lives. Given that people watching is a widespread activity, others are probably watching us about as much as we watch them. Yet research reported in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology suggests that most people watchers are not aware of this. In 6 studies, participants consistently tended to estimate that they observed strangers more than strangers observed them. Even making direct eye contact with someone might not be enough to undermine this belief. When roughly 100 Yale students were questioned about the conclusions they typically reached upon meeting the gaze of a stranger, fewer than a quarter said that they believed they were being observed.
Speaker C.
There is a theory that playing music makes you more intelligent and thus academically more successful. This conviction has encouraged countless ambitious parents to enroll their children in after-school music classes. But Professor Glenn Schellenberg says that it is a waste of time for children to attend music lessons purely in order to improve their educational performance. Schellenberg studied the link between musical training and intelligence in 130 children. He found that when he factored in the likely effect of each child's personality traits, in particular conscientiousness, the link between music training and intelligence disappeared. Conscientious children tend to take music lessons more often than others, but it's their personality type, not their violin or piano playing, that makes them do well at school.
Speaker D.
Ask around and you'll discover that almost everyone can recall being stuck next to a stranger who wouldn't stop going on about his or her health, job or marriage. The Harvard sociologist Mario Small says that we all tend to confide in strangers more than we realise. Almost half the respondents in a study led by Professor Small, when asked who they'd most recently confided in, admitted that it wasn't someone who they knew well. In a lonely, atomised society, it might seem that we simply turn in desperation to whoever happens to be around. And in a minority of cases, Mario Small did indeed find that sheer availability was the key factor. But his research shows that we frequently choose strangers on purpose because they are more likely to lend an ear and less likely to judge than those with whom we have the strongest bonds. Task 2. Read the instructions and the questions for text 1 carefully. Listen to the recording for text 1.
I'm an aerialist. I've performed in almost 5,000 shows for Cirque du Soleil, and like most performers, I've made my fair share of mistakes in front of a live audience. I work 40 feet up in the air without a net. In 97 out of 100 shows, I'm pretty much flawless from the audience's perspective. Most mistakes in those shows are things that only my acrobatic partner is aware of. Even our coaches don't often notice them, or if they do, they generally assume that we are trying out some new moves for our routine. Unlike juggling or a high-flying trapeze act, where mistakes involve a drop or a fall, ours will end up with extra spins, steps, or alternate landings, of which you, the audience, will be totally oblivious. I live for those three other shows, though, the ones where the mischievous fairies of live theatre toss all your careful plans out of the window. I have unintentionally gone sliding across a stage on my side, twirling around wildly, trying to get control and having to pull myself up onto one knee with a wide smile so as to cover up the mistake. I've wiped up accidental oil spills on stage, as if that were part of the show, and artistically swept snow from malfunctioning fog machines. Every time I make improvised art out of tripping or missing and being too human, I go home feeling as if I have earned the audience's applause. So how do we do it? Being an aerialist with a long-term partner, we've got the luxury of having done this thousands of times, which enables us to glide smoothly through our act. But it's the problem-solving hours that really count. When we go through the choreography, we have to foresee moments where we may have to improvise scenes if we have a fall, or cut entire sections of our act without a word if, for example, the stage lifts fail to work. That allows us to jump to plan B, C, or D instantly. And it also allows one of us to take control while the other instantly adapts. A couple of times a year, something really unanticipated happens. These are the things you go home thinking about and looking at from every angle, wondering what you could have done to cover them up better.
Listen to the recording once again.
I'm an aerialist. I've performed in almost 5,000 shows for Cirque du Soleil, and like most performers, I've made my fair share of mistakes in front of a live audience. I work 40 feet up in the air without a net. In 97 out of 100 shows, I'm pretty much flawless from the audience's perspective. Most mistakes in those shows are things that only my acrobatic partner is aware of. Even our coaches don't often notice them, or if they do, they generally assume that we are trying out some new moves for our routine. Unlike juggling or a high-flying trapeze act, where mistakes involve a drop or a fall, ours will end up with extra spins, steps, or alternate landings, of which you, the audience, will be totally oblivious. I live for those three other shows, though, the ones where the mischievous fairies of live theatre toss all your careful plans out of the window. I have unintentionally gone sliding across a stage on my side, twirling around wildly, trying to get control and having to pull myself up onto one knee with a wide smile so as to cover up the mistake. I've wiped up accidental oil spills on stage, as if that were part of the show, and artistically swept snow from malfunctioning fog machines. Every time I make improvised art out of tripping or missing and being too human, I go home feeling as if I have earned the audience's applause. So how do we do it? Being an aerialist with a long-term partner, we've got the luxury of having done this thousands of times, which enables us to glide smoothly through our act. But it's the problem-solving hours that really count. When we go through the choreography, we have to foresee moments where we may have to improvise scenes if we have a fall, or cut entire sections of our act without a word if, for example, the stage lifts fail to work. That allows us to jump to plan B, C, or D instantly. And it also allows one of us to take control while the other instantly adapts. A couple of times a year, something really unanticipated happens. These are the things you go home thinking about and looking at from every angle, wondering what you could have done to cover them up better.
Read the questions for text 2. Listen to the recording for text 2.
With us today in the studio is Eden Full, a Princeton student who has developed a remarkable device called the Sun Saluter. Eden, is the Sun Saluter a special kind of solar panel?
It's actually a device that allows regular solar panels to track the sun without the use of an electric motor. In this way, the Sun Saluter boosts the amount of energy that a solar panel produces. In fact, it's been shown to increase the overall output by 40%. It's relatively inexpensive to build and maintain, and because it's made entirely from bamboo and metal elements, it's non-toxic and fully recyclable. Above all, the simplicity of the design makes it accessible to all. Even children can learn how to construct a sun saluter.
Eden, you're just 19 years old and studying to become a mechanical engineer. How did the idea of the sun saluter evolve?
It all began quite a long time ago. From an early age, my parents instilled in me a sense of responsibility towards the environment. I fell in love with the idea of clean technology, and I built my first solar-powered car when I was 9 years old. As I got older, I became frustrated with how solar panels were not optimized to achieve their maximum potential, and I came up with the idea of the Sun Saluter. I experimented with it for several years, and I was finally able to unveil the prototype at the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair in 2008. There I met a friend from Indonesia who suggested that I take the technology to developing countries. I suddenly saw the Sun Saluter's potential to make a difference to people's lives worldwide, and that gave me the impetus to take things forward. Finally, what really helped the Sun Saluter gain momentum was the fellowship grant I got from the Thiel Foundation. It allowed me to take 2 years off from college and focus on enhancing the technology and the device itself.
Can you tell us more about the potential impact of this technology on people's lives?
Access to energy is something we tend to take for granted in the Western world, and the switch to renewable sources is driven by a desire to reduce pollution caused by burning fossil fuels. In developing countries, however, communities often have no access to electricity at all and therefore have no choice but, for example, to burn kerosene gas for light at night, which is expensive and dangerous. But more than being merely a source of clean energy, the Sun Saluter has the potential to transform local communities, often overlooked by the traditional economy. After introducing the technology, we want to help local entrepreneurs to establish self-sustaining social enterprises around it. We currently have a pilot project in India, which we hope will be a model for other communities around the world. But remember that there are a million ways to build a Sun Saluter, and you can adapt it depending on your location.
Listen to the recording once again.
With us today in the studio is Eden Full, a Princeton student who has developed a remarkable device called the Sun Saluter. Eden, is the Sun Saluter a special kind of solar panel?
It's actually a device that allows regular solar panels to track the sun without the use of an electric motor. In this way, the Sun Saluter boosts the amount of energy that a solar panel produces. In fact, it's been shown to increase the overall output by 40%. It's relatively inexpensive to build and maintain, and because it's made entirely from bamboo and metal elements, it's non-toxic and fully recyclable. Above all, the simplicity of the design makes it accessible to all. Even children can learn how to construct a sun saluter.
Eden, you're just 19 years old and studying to become a mechanical engineer. How did the idea of the sun saluter evolve?
It all began quite a long time ago. From an early age, my parents instilled in me a sense of responsibility towards the environment. I fell in love with the idea of clean technology, and I built my first solar-powered car when I was 9 years old. As I got older, I became frustrated with how solar panels were not optimized to achieve their maximum potential, and I came up with the idea of the Sun Saluter. I experimented with it for several years, and I was finally able to unveil the prototype at the Intel International Science and Engineering Fair in 2008. There I met a friend from Indonesia who suggested that I take the technology to developing countries. I suddenly saw the Sun Saluter's potential to make a difference to people's lives worldwide, and that gave me the impetus to take things forward. Finally, what really helped the Sun Saluter gain momentum was the fellowship grant I got from the Thiel Foundation. It allowed me to take 2 years off from college and focus on enhancing the technology and the device itself.
Can you tell us more about the potential impact of this technology on people's lives?
Access to energy is something we tend to take for granted in the Western world, and the switch to renewable sources is driven by a desire to reduce pollution caused by burning fossil fuels. In developing countries, however, communities often have no access to electricity at all, and therefore have no choice but, for example, to burn kerosene gas for light at night, which is expensive and dangerous. But more than being merely a source of clean energy, the Sun Saluter has the potential to transform local communities, often overlooked by the traditional economy. After introducing the technology, we want to help local entrepreneurs to establish self-sustaining social enterprises around it. We currently have a pilot project in India, which we hope will be a model for other communities around the world. But remember that there are a million ways to build a Sun Saluter, and you can adapt it depending on your location.
Task 3. Read the instructions and the task carefully.
Highway 1 is an iconic route, and the stretch known as the Big Sur is a cinematographer's dream. The twisting road from Carmel to Cambry in California clings defiantly to clifftops, and around every hairpin bend, yet another scene of wild beauty unfolds. However, I have to focus on the road, as it's a route that would challenge the most seasoned driver, and I'm still something of a newbie, with little more than a year's driving under my belt. Earlier that year, on a cold January day in the UK, I had finally passed my driving test. At the age of 46, it was a personal triumph, In the following months, I ticked off many driving milestones on Britain's roads. A first tentative trip into London, or a journey around Cornwall's narrow lanes. Meanwhile, my life took its own unanticipated swerve when I was made redundant from a magazine job I adored. Having the security of work ripped away shook my confidence to the core. Thinking what to do next with my life, I decided to fulfill my dream of going on a ride along the Big Sur. After a comedic bunny hop exit from the car lot at the San Francisco airport, I soon found myself on the freeway, steadying my nerves as I became accustomed to driving on the right and the American's impatience behind the wheel. But when the city's most famous landmark, the Golden Gate Bridge, faded from sight in the rearview mirror, my initial unease dissolved into a childlike joy. I could now enjoy my eagerly anticipated date with the Big Sur. The first stop, 30 minutes later, is Carmel. I wander down to the beach. Time comes to a standstill, and I reflect on my journey so far. Tackling this route has recharged my confidence reserves. The sun quickly burns away the fog, further stimulating my sense of optimism. It remains with me for the rest of the journey. On the way back, I decide to visit Monterey and join a whale-watching tour at Fisherman's Wharf. We head out into the Pacific and are rewarded with several sightings of majestic humpback whales. Gazing around at my fellow passengers, I am struck by the thought that beyond the desire to see whales, we have another thing in common. We are determined to discover more about ourselves. And although we are sharing this experience temporarily, everyone is on their own journey.
Listen to the recording once again.
Highway 1 is an iconic route, and the stretch known as the Big Sur is a cinematographer's dream. The twisting road from Carmel to Cambria in California clings defiantly to clifftops, and around every hairpin bend, yet another scene of wild beauty unfolds. However, I have to focus on the road, as it's a route that would challenge the most seasoned driver, and I'm still something of a newbie, with little more than a year's driving under my belt. Earlier that year, on a cold January day in the UK, I had finally passed my driving test. At the age of 46, it was a personal triumph. In the following months, I ticked off many driving milestones on Britain's roads, a first tentative trip into London, or a journey around Cornwall's narrow lanes. Meanwhile, my life took its own unanticipated swerve when I was made redundant from a magazine job I adored. Having the security of work ripped away shook my confidence to the core. Thinking what to do next with my life, I decided to fulfill my dream of going on a ride along the Big Sur. After a comedic bunny hop exit from the car lot at the San Francisco airport, I soon found myself on the freeway, steadying my nerves as I became accustomed to driving on the right and the American's impatience behind the wheel. But when the city's most famous landmark, the Golden Gate Bridge, faded from sight in the rearview mirror, my initial unease dissolved into a childlike joy. I could now enjoy my eagerly anticipated date with the Big Sur. The first stop, 30 minutes later, is Carmel. I wander down to the beach. Time comes to a standstill, and I reflect on my journey so far. Tackling this route has recharged my confidence reserves. The sun quickly burns away the fog, further stimulating my sense of optimism. It remains with me for the rest of the journey. On the way back, I decide to visit Monterey and join a whale-watching tour at Fisherman's Wharf. We head out into the Pacific and are rewarded with several sightings of majestic humpback whales. Gazing around at my fellow passengers, I am struck by the thought that beyond the desire to see whales, we have another thing in common. We are determined to discover more about ourselves. And although we are sharing this experience temporarily, everyone is on their own journey.
Czas przeznaczony na tę część egzaminu minął.